Hi, everyone. This is your co-host, Stu, and I'm here with the paranormalist, Patty Wilson. Hi, Patty. What's up?
Hello. It is a beautiful day. It was amazingly warm for beginnings of February, so I'm in a great mood. Plus, I found out some really interesting information that led me down a merry path to where we're going to go tonight.
Please consider clicking the like or subscribe button that's down below. And you also find in the description of this video everything related to the Paranormalist Podcast, the Facebook groups, email address, and all of the associated other things with it, including Patty's books on Amazon. So thank you, and here we go with the episode. So what do you have for us this evening?
Well, as I've said multiple times throughout the podcast, one of my favorite heroes as a writer is Elliot O'Donnell. And browsing around looking for some different information, I came across this really cool little article about Elliot O'Donnell. So he was born in 1872. He died in 1965 at the age of 93. And he never stopped writing. One of his later books, one I had never heard of, they gave you a link to it in a PDF. Well, let me tell you, it has been a sheer joy to spend some time with Elliot O'Donnell and hear him tell some amazingly new tales. If you know what I mean. So
yeah, you were telling stories like back in the elementary school days with the you had the I can't even remember the name of the company now. They came out with the paperback books, and you brought in your little order form, and you paid like 25 or 35 cents.
Weekly Readers.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, I thought the Weekly Reader is more like a magazine. No, this was actually a at least in my elementary school, it was a not quite a book club, but it was something like that. It was to introduce. Okay. You know, to get kids into reading.
I think of it that way because it was always tucked into my Weekly Reader.
Maybe. Possibly. But I remember I got, you know, even in elementary school, I bought the a thing about the ghost of Lincoln. And that was a great. But I remember you saying about, you know, that was your introduction to Elliot O'Donnell.
Yeah. Yes. And I've always loved his books. So I came across this PDF and began to read, and he was telling this amazing story. But a gentleman by the name of Captain Morgan, who was a kind of a affable, cheerful, elderly gentleman in about 1841, who was staying in London. He puts up in this big old fashioned hotel with heavy furniture, kind of antique-y looking, like they haven't changed the decor in 100 years, you know, kind of a deal. And it reminded him of a murder mystery novel, the atmosphere of this hotel, you know, like it was waiting for something to happen. Very uncomfortable in some respects. So he decides that it's just, you know, better to go to bed and go to sleep and get on with his business the next day so that, you know, he can pass through this hotel and move on to wherever else he was headed. And he goes to bed in this great big old four-poster bed that's in there. And he wakes up in the middle of the night to ruffling, flattering, flapping sounds. And he's like, what is that? And he sits up and he realizes there's this huge blackbird with its wings outstretched and red eyes perched on the railing at the foot of the four-poster bed. Well, you can imagine that that's kind of bizarre. And I have to tell you, I have awakened to something similar because animals get in houses. You know, sometimes you leave a window open or something happens. And as he's looking at it, trying to make sense out of it in the middle of the night, the bird flies directly at his face. And he jukes, he pulls the blanket up over his face a second and jumps out of the bed, drops the blanket and runs for the sofa in the corner of the room, where he sits there and he's watching the bird trying to figure out what to do about this. The bird lunges at him again and he's still got that blanket kind of laying halfway on his lap and halfway on the ground. And he grabs it up and he throws it over the great big blackbird. And he's not sure what to make of all this, but he sits up for a while and then finally falls asleep sitting on the couch. Sure, he's not going to go back and lay down in that bed because he can't explain what all has just occurred to him. He begins to think about it and he said, he wondered always if it was an earthbound spirit of a criminal or a viciously inclined person who had once lived on the earth and who had become the phantom of a bird, or was it truly just the ghost of a bird? He writes about this in his journal and tells his story several times. it was just interesting. And it kind of was the beginning story in this book. And one of the reasons that I thought that was fascinating is because Elliot O'Donnell, in one of his books, there's a book on animal hauntings, and he writes this really interesting quote that he believes that people are born with two spirits, an animal spirit and a human spirit, and that whichever spirit you allow to participate in your life, whether it's the animal or the human, that is what you'll come back as when you die. You come back as a twisted animal in some way, you know, maybe crippled or something. Or if you were human, then if you come back, you come back as a human being. But whatever nature that you encouraged in your life is the nature that you will end up facing and existing in when you die. And I just thought it was fascinating. So that took me down this weird rabbit hole of bizarre animal hauntings and examining them from both what could they be, whether they were really just an animal haunting or if they were something else completely different. And so I thought we would try going through some of these stories and take a look at some of these bizarre hauntings. So in Essex, England, there was a home that was haunted by what they called spectral birds. This was recorded in writing in journals and other letters and what have you throughout the years. It was a bird the size of a raven, often seen in the house. They became very accustomed to it just fluttering out of nowhere and not to disappear right through the ceiling or disappear in midair. But it wasn't confined to just the house. It fluttered through the walls into the other houses. You know how row houses are in a city where they share a singular wall on each side? It would float through one wall into the next house and onto the next and onto the next. And other times people would see the same bird or what they took to be the same bird. And it would be out in the woods or the moors or out in the commons. And that they said that they saw this bird in the parks and all over the place. And hauntings by birds just seemed to be fascinatingly common. I had no clue till I started looking. And not just birds, not just average birds, but other birds as well. And I came across some really interesting stories, so I wanted to talk a little bit about this. One of the things that I found really interesting was that these birds seem to often represent evil acts or something that has happened. Sometimes they actually, there's a one story we're going to talk about where they actually represent something that was evil that occurred to a bunch of birds, but we're going to talk about some of it. So outside of, we're going to start with England and work our way around, because not just, obviously not just in England, not just birds, but we'll start with that and work our way through. So in Worcester, England, there is a castle there. It's called the Worcester Castle. It's a cathedral that was built in the Church of Christ, and it's blessed, and it's been there since 1084. So it's ancient compared to anything in this country. And it's very well known for its architecture. It's beautiful. It's where the tomb of John, King of England, is located. There is just obviously so many stories about this place. But what I found interesting is that one of the things they talk about is that it's haunted, and it's haunted by not a human and not a bird, but a bear. And they have no clue as to what the, you know, why a bear. So this was during the Civil War, the English Civil War, and King Charles II was taking advantage of, you know, he was taking advantage of a defensive position. And the story goes that he took up residence at the Worcester Cathedral, where he could store weapons, he could use it as a space of operation, and what have you. The sentries were stationed around, and allegedly there was a man by the name of Simon Jones, who was doing his duty at the cathedral's green college. And he was the first known person to see the apparition of what they call the Ghost Bear of Worcester. So the story says that dates back to 1691. This is the first time it was ever written. It was written in a book called The Certainty of the World of Spirits. And according to this story, as it was written then, Jones was a strong, healthy young man, no way inclined to fantasy or what have you, and was a singular sound mind, very resolute. He had been a soldier for the king in the war, and one night he's running guard duty when he's standing as a sentinel at College Green, when something that he described as a headless bear appeared to him and frightened. This is from the actual book, and affrighted him that he laid down his arms soon after and lived honestly, religiously, and without blame the rest of his life. In other words, he abandoned ship.
Nope, I'm out.
I'm done. Seen more than I wanted to see. After this initial encounter, other soldiers began talking about seeing this headless bear. And there's no story that anybody can link to this story. They just began to see this headless bear. There there's speculation that there was somebody who had a trained bear, but that wouldn't explain it being without its head. And the soldiers who saw it all were resolute in the fact that they saw a headless bear walking on all fours or on two legs rearing up at them, and they can't explain what happened. And it goes back to that, was that a soldier that, you know, chose to appear in that method, or was there a story that is yet to be uncovered about what happened to an animal in that spot?
Certainly one of a kind story, at least.
Well, so I thought. However,
how many headless bears do you meet?
Well, I mean, not just headless bears, but bizarre stories. I mean,
no, I was thinking singularly the headless bear. You know, how many other headless bear stories do you have?
Well, believe it or not, and not just headless bears, but headless animals. There are multiples of them. I didn't choose to tell all of them, but I probably ran across six or eight in the research, a couple of which I might share tonight. So then you go on to Dunchurch, which is in Warwickshire, and there you come across a ghostly cow. So there was supposedly a giant cow that was kept by a giant man who lived in Shropshire. The cow lived of a good life, and it supposedly gave a huge amount of milk. Now, for those who don't know, milk is what given in gallons, by when you weigh it, you give it in pounds. This cow afforded the giant quite a nice living. If you get my drift, he would sell the milk. And so the cow was very important to him. And one day there was a man who came by. He was a witch, but the giant didn't know it. And he demanded that he give him the milk from the cow. And the giant was like, no, why would I give you the milk from this cow that I sell to make a living so I can buy comforts? And the witch got angry and put a spell on the cow. And it went rogue, and it began like trashing people's barns, running through their cabins. It was just, it was huge, so it could do a lot of damage. So it was ordered that this cow be slain, and it was killed. And it was so big that the rib bones from the cow would eventually be put on display in the center of town to show what a giant cow, because nobody believed such a silly story. But you could see this, and it is said that the cow would come back in its ghostly form every so many years and just appear. But here's the interesting thing. When it appears near Warwick Castle, one of the members of the Warwick family will die. It was a Warwick who had slain the cow, and so it is a harbinger of bringing justice to the Warwick family as the years have gone by.
Interesting.
Yeah, I just didn't expect some of the stories that I came across. And yet here we are. The bizarre story. So this is only one haunted animal, again, multiple of them, that are also harbingers of death or ill fortune or something of that nature. And so now we're going to move on to Catergate, which is a crazy story too. It is the story of a ghost pig and her piglets. Just saying.
I you know, nothing should surprise me anymore.
So this pig and her piglets, you know, they would, what do pigs do? They root around and they eat. They just kind of wander around and eat. So she was, you know, feeding some piglets, and she was always hungry, and she would go wandering around and root up the ground and find some things that she could eat. They eat grubs and grass and anything they could get their little cloven hooves on, you know.
Truffles.
And yeah, I mean, that's what they do. They truffles anything. So one night, you know, she would, she was a foggy night, and the cow was out, or the pig was out with her little piglets, and they were ruffling around, and then that was the end of it. Nobody could find her or the piglets anymore. The supposition by the farmer who owned her was that she was probably stolen, and so were the piglets, and probably butchered and eaten. As you can imagine, I mean, people were hungry, and so who's going to turn down a fine pork meal, maybe many fine pork meals. So one night after all of this has occurred, this strange encounter happens. There was a traveler coming through the area, and he was walking along the road. It was kind of a misty night, and he heard that loud grunting, snuffling sound of a pig, right? And he's thinking, I better be careful because I don't want to run into a hog. People that don't, our city people don't know this, but hogs are extremely dangerous animals. They literally can kill and eat a human and not blink a whisker, if you will, wiggle a whisker doing so. So they are a dangerous animal, not only when they're feral, but when they're left run loose. And so, you know, the man knew this and he was afraid. So he decides that he better kind of hurry on his way. And that's when he heard this grunting, running sound coming at him. And then more startling was this low squealing sound. And he's sure the pig is upon him. It's right behind him, somewhere in the darkness, somewhere in the fog. And he's like, why is it chasing me? And he starts to run. Why is it chasing me? And that's when things got weird. Not that they hadn't been before. But according to the man, he heard this word said, starvin, 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 in this very bizarre, high-pitched sounding voice, followed by a deeper human voice that replied, Catergate, Catergate, dead hoss, dead hoss. The man then suddenly felt a cold chill of air rush past him as the mist began to part, and out of the mist came the old pig and her litter of pigs. They were see-through and bathed in an eerie green light. The little spectral pigs running around the mother, they ignored the startled man and continued on their way, running forward as if looking for something. When he got to the town, he was rattled, as you can well imagine, and he stopped in the local pub and bent his elbow and began to ask around about, is there anything weird on that road? And he was told that the farmer had lied and told people that the pigs had been killed, but that years later it was discovered that he had gotten angry at the sow and had starved her and the piglets to death.
Oh.
Hungry, hungry. Colgate. And so what a strange and strange story. And there are other people who talked about the story about having heard this spectral pig speaking. There was one that said that the pigs were squealing, skin and bones, skin and bones. And then you would hear another voice say, let them lie, let them lie. And again, often you would hear other things. One was that the pig goes a-traipsing and back off across the moor, and 'tis God's honest truth, I heard the voices cry as they faded into the night, is one written account. So what a strange story to imagine. And I have to tell you, it reminds me very much of something that I kind of have to wonder about. So in central Pennsylvania here, there is a story of about a place where a guy had he had a pig farm. It made the news. I don't know if you've heard this story, about 5-6 years ago now. And he had this farm. He had about 100, a little over 100 pigs on the farm. And he contacted a real estate agent and asked the real estate agent if she could sell the farm. He was leaving. He was going to get rid of the farm. And she said, sure, no problem. So she finds somebody who's interested in buying the farm. And she says, sure, I'll meet you out there at the farm. Not a problem. And they get out to the farm. And I've never understood this story. But as she pulls in, you know, the people are standing there. And it was like, there's this awful smell. And she's like, it's a pig farm. Of course, there's an awful smell. Pigs are a very distinctive and terrible smell. They do. The smell of a pig will actually get into your skin and your clothes. You have to bath. It's a very distinctive smell. She gets out of the car and it hits her. And she's like, wait a second. That's not pig smell. She starts walking around and she comes rushing back from the barn. And she says to them, we need to get out of here now. We need to get out of here now. She's very rattled. And they go down the road a ways. She pulls off in a wide spot where she has cell service and she calls the police. And the young couple that's looking at buying this farm had pulled over to make sure she was okay. And they kept saying, what did you see? What's wrong? What did you see? And she's like, I've never seen anything like it. And so the long and the short of the story is the guy left and he left all the pigs there. He assumed that his wife was going to come back as they had split up and feed them. She assumed that he would do it. And he had let 100 pigs starve to death. And the people who purchased the farm subsequently and cleaned up everything claimed that they would hear the pigs squealing in the night, even though everything had been removed.
Yeah, and I bet at some point pigs aren't picky. So. No. 100 exactly. Would have become 90, then 80, then yeah. Mm. Oh my. At least though, they didn't become articulate like the ones in the, which is, to me, that's the most fascinating thing. Okay, a ghost pig and piglets, to me, that's not out of the ordinary. But when they start talking, you know, that's a different story.
Yeah. So they're telling their tale in the only way, you know, that was allowed to them. A tale that, like, nobody knew at first. It took a while for them to piece it together, what had really happened to these animals. But apparently he had locked them in a stall and starved them to death, and it was only upon his own demise that people came onto the property and found what he had done in his anger. So we're moving on to Highgate in London. There's supposed to be a ghost chicken in an area known as the Pond Square, and this chicken began to be seen in the 17th century. Y'all could be laughing at me, but I like phantom fowl, okay? Mm. I have a book which is called Totally Bizarre PA, and I have a story in there about a chicken that haunts. So according to this, Sir Francis Bacon and a friend of his, Mr. Witherbone, bought a chicken from a farm in the area for the purpose of killing it, plucking it, and stuffing it in the snow. Now, this wasn't just cruelty. Francis Bacon was fascinated with science, so was Dr. Witherbone, and what they were trying to figure out, and you owe them a great debt if you have a freezer or a refrigerator. What they were trying to figure out was, if you stuck it in the snow, could you keep it fresh longer in the cold? Because up till that point in time, nobody had done that. But he had noted, you know, tried other objects. And so they bought this chicken and they decided to do it. And they figured it out. You can, if you chill the animal, the carcass, you can definitely keep it longer. As we all know, it seems like simple common knowledge today, but it all kind of started with these experiments. Mm-hmm. Now, right after all of this happens, Francis Bacon dies from pneumonia. Dr. Witherbone would be left to be haunted. The story goes that the chicken appears on the farm where Dr. Witherbone lives, or lived, and has since haunted that same property. He is, it appears plucked and gutted and runs in circles in the square and in the little yard before vanishing into thin air. Sightings are apparently frequently, was apparently happening frequently during World War II, at which time there were air raid wardens trying to catch this crazy bird because they didn't know what it was and they weren't sure. And it was World War II. Everybody was thinking there was some sort of crazy German whatever, you know? So, but every time anybody's ever gotten close to the bird, it evaporates into thin air. It is still seen to this day, off and on, in that region, down by the pond.
That's a persistent spirit.
It is. It's a plucky little fowl, if you don't mind me saying so.
Oh, I can't handle the punishment.
Well, you can't help it when you're punny, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So another story that I thought was pretty interesting, I thought this is a little more serious. There's a place in North Wales, and it's called Brian Yamad. And there have been stories for generations and generations about this white horse that runs down this section of road, bears off from one lane into another little tributary. And this story dates back from the 1800s all the way through to today. In fact, there's a really interesting story where a man was driving the back roads just before daylight. Basically, he didn't have any tags on his car. So he decided to do the moving around when he figured the cops were laying low because it's like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And just as dawn's breaking, he's driving along this road, and out of nowhere, over a hedge, leaps this white horse. And he thought the horse was going to literally go through the car windshield at him. It came that quickly and filled the windshield. And wow. If anybody's ever hit a deer like that, that happens in just a second. You have almost no response time. And he screams, he turns the wheel, he slams the brakes, he spins to a stop, gets out of the car, fully expecting a dead or damaged horse and his car to be in disarray and smashed up, but nothing. He reports it to the police because he's that rattled. And a couple weeks later, there's a young couple driving the same road. They again approach the same area. And again, out of nowhere comes this great big, beautiful white stallion. And it leaps across the hedgerow, literally almost into the car. The couple screams. They try to avoid it, spin out of control, end up sitting in the middle of the crossroad there and get out expecting this horse and to be dead or damaged. Nothing there. This has been going on for a long time, and these are only just two police reports, and these are more recent ones. Not so long ago, a couple years back, they were working on the road, the local constabulary. They had hired a crew to work on the road to repair it and prep it to get redone, you know, concrete poured on it and what have you. And during that time, they found a horse's skull right at the area where the hedgerow was, where the horse was seen leaping across. There's no explanation, no great story that goes with it, but they cannot help but wonder if somebody had killed that horse there or it had died there and been buried there, and it was still just going through whatever the motions were that it had gone through in its life. And the skull of the horse seems to indicate that something must have happened there. I thought it was an interesting story because the story happened before the corroboration could even occur. So people had been seeing it for a long, long time. And then eventually when they were digging to put the new road in, they came across it. Makes you wonder about what might be buried around your home or the woods or, you know, things like that. Because we don't realize it, but everywhere's a graveyard. Some fashion.
Oh, yeah, easily.
So we're going to move on to Newgate Prison, which is stood by Old Bailey. And it has a story about a supernatural hound, a great big hound dog, that was an omen of bad luck. A prison inmate wrote about this in 1596. This is the first written account of it, although there are oral accounts that predate this one that are referenced. So that's a long time ago that this dog's been here. So the story is that there was a terrible famine going on in London in that time frame, and prison inmates had turned to cannibalism to live. I mean, it is what it is. That's what the time frame was like. And people will survive however they can. There was a man who was a teacher who was imprisoned at the time, having been accused of witchcraft, I'm sure, because he was doing mathematical equations or whatever it was he was doing, you know? And when he arrived, he was overpowered by some of the men who were in the prison. And unfortunately, he became dinner. Shortly thereafterwards, the inmates began to see this huge black dog stalking the corridors. And each of the men who had attacked the teacher were hunted down and torn apart by the beast. The prison guards would see it. It would pass through them. It would pass through the walls. And when it hit the person, it just leaped on that person that had helped kill the scholar, the teacher. It suddenly became flesh and bone and able to tear this person apart. But whenever someone tried to intervene, their hands would pass through it as though there was nothing there. Eventually, it got most of the men, and a couple that were still left were terrified of what was their pending fate, and managed to break out of the jail. But it is said that the dog stopped hunting the prison for a while those men were on the loose. And then when it returned to continue stalking the prison, well, the inmates took it to mean it had completed its task. I just think it's a fascinating story. And it's an example of what Elliot O'Donnell had talked about, that whatever your nature was, human or animal, might be what you choose to be. And this person who had died such a horrible death, fate afterward, had chosen to come back and vindicate himself, shall we say. So moving on to Washington, D.C.,
okay.
There are some really cool stories. So there's a story of a demon cat in the White House that is supposed to walk the halls at night. This takes place just after the American Civil War. There was a watchman there who began to see this black cat, and it would come running, you know, down outside there, down the tunnel. You know, there's these tunnels under the Capitol. So people don't know that there's tunnels under the White House and under the Capitol buildings and what have you. And it would come out of one of them and run toward them and look like a regular black cat. But as it got toward them, it would begin to grow. It was almost to the size of a panther. There's one account where one of the men held his ground, and the cat became, this is their quote, the size of a tiger, and leapt at him. He brought up his arms in fear, screaming, fearing that he was going to be savaged by the animal, only to realize that nothing struck him. And when he lowered his hands, there was nothing there. At first, it became the story that, there was a drunken night watchman. And then there was a couple. They had been imbibing together, and on until, you know, people began to have their own experiences, sober people of stature, if you will.
Okay.
One of the interesting things, though, I thought about it is when they poured concrete for flooring after there had been a gas explosion in 1898 in the tunnels below the president, you know, the White House, the men who were pouring the concrete left it for the night, and the following morning they found 6 to 8 great big paw prints, as though a lion had run through the wet concrete. They started in the middle of a long, narrow lane, and they ended further down, but still in the middle, where there was nowhere for the cat to go. It's not a well-known story, but I thought it was fascinating. For those who don't know, in the background, you're hearing my cats talking. Apparently, they like it. I just thought it was really interesting. For those who have heard of some of the darker things, in Dublin, there was something in the 1800s, excuse me, late 1700s named the Hellfire Club. It was started by a guy by the name of Richard Parsons in 1735, and it was known for its satanic practices, its sex magic. It's the forerunner of what we will see Aleister Crowley do at the turn of the 20th century. He took a lot of it, his thelemic magic and what have you, from the wickedness of the Hellfire Club, which was infamous in the region. And it was believed that they actually sacrificed animals and humans inside these tunnels, these caves. They were caves in the side of the hills where they would meet. Interestingly enough, there may very well be a link between Richard Parsons and Jack Parsons, who we talked about in a couple other episodes, who was trying to bring to life the horror of Babylon to bring the end of the world. And he turned out to be a very colorful character. We did an episode several months back about him. But anyhow, the story goes that there were visitors to the Hellfire Club, which is now has been open as a museum, a tourist attraction, things like that. So these people were touring the area. They decided to go through it because it has a really interesting and mysterious reputation. And there's just a niche, if you will, for that kind of tourism. The next day, the guy was found dead. He was scratched and torn to pieces. So somebody mentioned that he had been in the Hellfire Club the night before, down there touring in those tunnels and inside that cave. There was another fellow who had been with this man who died, and he immediately decided he needed to get to a Catholic priest and confess his sins and what have you, which he was hoping that whatever had happened, it wouldn't infringe on him. There was scheduled to be an event at the Hellfire Club that very night. Now, as I said, it was open as a tourist attraction. So they actually had these like reenactment type things going on in there where you could kind of mock the debauchery and the bizarre. I can't understand why anybody would go for this, but there are people who do. So as they were sitting there having this great big feast and, you know, explaining how this would have led to this particular act or that particular incantation or what have you, out of nowhere, a black cat, huge black cat, stalked into the room. Its ears were laid back, and when it lifted its ears up, they looked more like horns. There was somebody there who had brought holy water with him because he was a little bit afraid of all of it. According to the story, he grabbed the holy water out of his pocket and threw it at the cat, and the cat burst into pieces, like it exploded. And when he went outside, they all took off running, as you can well imagine. This is a horrific, weird story. And they go outside, and the gentleman who had been hosting, pretending to be Richard Parsons, was laying on the ground with his neck and face deeply scratched, as though he had been attacked by a large cat, and he was dead. And it is believed that when this cat appears, it comes to kill. So if I were you, I wouldn't be doing any tourism.
Not a problem.
Yeah, not for me either, because like I'm not interested. I just found it fascinating. So I wanted to share one last story, and then we'll be done for tonight. Okay. And these stories are really interesting to me, in large part because there are some of them you can see almost a human component in. The pig story. I can't explain why the plucked chicken is running around, but, you know, is it just the horror of what happened to it? But it was just a fascinating story. I just share one last story with you. So this story, we started with Elliot O'Donnell. We'll leave with Elliot O'Donnell. This is another story from one of his books, Credit Where It's Due. And this is The Headless Cat of Lower Sedley Road. The story is written from the mid-1800s, and it talks about this family who rented a house on Lower Sedley Road. And when they first settled into the house, everything was cool. The house was beautiful. They had their servants. It was a really reasonably priced house. I am always questioning any place where the rent is reasonably priced because every story starts that way. You know, you're like, really? It's only like, you know, X number of dollars. How come? What's haunting it? Every story seems to start that way. Anyhow, this gentleman moved in with his wife and children, his servants, and just settled down. Now, the rest of what I'm going to read to you are from journal entries that Elliot O'Donnell was able to obtain about this particular family. This came from the gentleman's journals. And the gentleman's name was Mr. Robert Dane. And these are his quotes. I'll paraphrase them slightly just to move them faster. So the first time they had an experience of anything was a few weeks after moving into the house. It was October. It was late in the evening, about 11 p.m. And Robert and his brother-in-law were sitting in the den. They were having an evening cigar and getting ready to go to bed. His brother-in-law had come to spend the weekend, you know, visit with the family. And as they were sitting there sort of in the dark with just a little bit of fire still burning feebly in the fireplace, they had this bizarre experience. The brother-in-law threw the stub of his cigar into the fireplace, you know, to get rid of it. And all of a sudden, the brother-in-law said, "You're going to think me mad, but there is something very queer about this place tonight. The atmosphere, I don't know what it is. I've never felt anything like it here or anywhere else." And then he kind of gasped and he said, "Look at the cigar end." And Robert looked into the fire and he wrote, "To my shock, what I saw was certainly not the stub of my brother-in-law's cigar, but an eye, a large red and lurid eye that looked at us with an expression of hatred, just an eye." And he said his brother-in-law grabbed a shovel and struck at it, but with no effect, it still stayed there glaring at us. And a horror seized us that made it unable for us to move. We sat and glared at it, glaring at us, until the clock in the hall outside struck 12, and then suddenly the eye was gone. Coals were going cold. And we both felt that this terrible influence, whatever it was evil, but it had been removed. So moving on to the next, they kind of spent a restless night, as you can well imagine. The next day, this gentleman, Robert's wife, she comes into the room and she's pretty rattled. And she says to him, "I've heard these horrible noises on the landing, as if there was a cat being worried to death by dogs." And as she's telling him about what she's just heard out in the hallway, he hears it coming down the stairs toward them. And it sounds for all the world like a cat being, you know, tortured by a dog. And there's hissing and scratching and screaming and squealing and barking and all of this going on at the same time. And this is just before bed. And he goes out fully expecting, now they had no house pets, fully expecting that perhaps they left the door open and a dog and a cat had gotten in somehow. They had a cat outside and they had a dog outside. So they thought perhaps, but they go out and they see nothing, but they hear the sounds still. And she runs to the door and she makes sure everything's closed, nothing's open. He opens the door to check outside to see if something is like just outside the door being tortured. And nothing. As soon as he opens the door, the sound is gone. And he said, "I could see our black tomcat sitting on the roof, not the worse for wear." And then he said, "I could see our dog, a terrier, running out the gate, not seeming to notice anything was wrong. I told my wife it must be imagination, and we went to bed." Fast forward to the 21st of October, he said they were in bed when he felt a rush of cold. First at the bend of the staircase, the candle flared up a bright blue flame, and then an animal of some sorts came tearing down the stairs past me, and peering over the banister, I saw looking up at me from the well in the depths of the darkness, a set of red eyes that reminded me of what we had seen in the fireplace. He threw the matchbox at it. It did not move. And he said, only when I switched on the electric light did it disappear. I searched the house most carefully. No animal was found. Hmm. On the 7th of November, he counts get escalate. He said, I was on my way to bed. He said, Tom and Mabel, those were their children, came running into my wife's room in great excitement, saying, Mama, Mama, hurry. There's a dog tearing a cat apart in the next room over. And she went running to see what they were talking about, fearing very much that that's the same thing she had heard, and it was. So she went screaming for her husband to come and help, to come and help. And he said, only when I got to the door and burst open did the sound cease. There was no animal within, no animal without. And I says, I have probed the mystery of the house. I think it is haunted. I think we must leave. On the 12th of November, he talks about he has somebody coming to sublet the house, a man named James Barstow. And he says, I hope he'll take it. On the 15th of November, while they're waiting for this man to make a decision, the cook tells them she's leaving today. She talks about in the middle of the night, she was awakened by what sounded like a cat and a dog right outside her door, and the poor cat was being torn to pieces. And as she sat up in the bed, she said something smacked into her body as though a cat had leapt on her. She could feel its claws and she could feel the ripping. And she pulls her dress shirt open for the lady to see, and there are scratches down her chest. And she said, there's nothing, not enough money in the world to induce me to stay in this house one more night. And she freely admitted she saw no one, she saw nothing, only the sounds and then the feeling of something heavy smacking her in the chest as it pounced on her. November 18th, about 11 p.m. This is the gentleman, Richard. I was in the bath when I heard something fall. It was a loud splash. I could not see what it was. Wait, no, there was nothing there. I ran to the stairs. I went up three stairs at a time. I will not go to that bath again. Sunday, November the 20th, went to church in the morning. And upon returning, I met my six-year-old daughter on the lane. Her name is Dot. She plucked at my arm, screaming, do hurry, mother is very ill. I ran for home and found my wife lying on a sofa crying in hysterics. It took fully an hour for her to tell me what had happened. This is her, what he says she told him. After you went to church, I made some custard pudding. She was cooking, getting things ready for the day. And she said, I was in the living room writing a letter to my mother while things were cooking when I heard a very pathetic mewling sound coming from under the sofa. I thought it was a stray cat and that someone had left a window open and it had gotten in. I tried to call it out, but as it would not move, I got to my knees and climbed under the edge of the couch. There was no cat there. And still the mewling was coming from that corner. I could hear it loudly. She said, barely had I been able to reconcile myself to the idea of ghosts in the room, but for the sunshine, I would have run. I went over instead and sat at my seat as if to do my writing, but not for long. The mewling grew nearer. I distinctly heard something crawl out from under the sofa. There was a pause. And then it sprang upon me and dug its claws into my knees. I looked down into my horror and distress, perceiving it stood on its hind legs, pawing my clothes, a large tabby cat without a head, the neck terminating in a mangled stump. The sight so appalling, I could not know what had happened. But nurse and the children came in that way at that moment and found me laying on the floor in hysterics. We must leave the house at once. Wednesday the 30th. Had an awful scurrying, trying to get everything packed. So they're getting ready to leave. He's packing up all the, having servants pack up all the dishes and what have you. And they're going to look for another house. He said his wife had forgotten her pocketbook, her purse, and she had sent him back to the house. She had been rattled and had been forgetful for the last few days. She was most anxiously to move. As I was looking through the house trying to find her purse, I called out to one of the servants cautiously, and the servant called back without opening the door and said, "There's something in there, sir." At that instant, I saw a cat. It vanished into the room, and as I reached the doorway, I pulled it open, and standing there, just as my wife had told me, there was a headless cat, just as described by my wife. I was in fear that it would lunge at me, but it faded away instead. We're coming to the last entries. The last entry. After innumerable inquiries, I have come to find that at a length of about 12 years ago, a Mr. and Mrs. Barlow lived in this house. They had one son, Arthur, whom they spoilt most outrageously, even to the extent of allowing him to participate in cruelty. To afford him amusement, they would buy rats for his dog, a fox terrier, to worry. And on one occasion, they procured a stray cat, which the servants afterward declared was mangled in a most shocking manner before it was destroyed by Arthur. Here, in my opinion, is the very feasible explanation for the haunting my family endured. The phenomena seen was the phantom of that poor, tortured cat. For if human tragedies are reenacted by ghosts, why not animal tragedies too? It is absurd to suppose that man has a monopoly of soul or spirit. And I agree. It's a most interesting story. And I find it fascinating that O'Donnell was able to follow it by journal entries as it increased in ferocity. And with that, I will say night.